and or over, I don't know which one, in the beginning of this little visit with Jimmy after supper this Tuesday, the 2nd of July. John went over, and Debbie reports on her experience at the horse farm after the horse show. She just happened into it. This is Sunday, the 7th of July, 74. Sunday, the 7th of July, 74. And Debbie reports on the horses after the horse show that she just stumbled into. This Sunday, the 7th of July, 74.
Her mother and Miss Alice, mm-hmm. or Aunt Alice,
mm-hmm.
and she wondered if you could send it along.
Just happened in.
I did. Late yesterday afternoon, I just decided that I'd go over and see that horse farm in Micanopy, you know, where Valerie and
yeah.
Sharon go. I hadn't been over there, and I just thought I'd ride over and see it. Sleepy Hollow. And I knew the sign was there, so I just, it was about 3:30, I guess, and I'd had about enough of typing and reading and doing, I needed to get out. So I drove up, and, there was a big sign that said visitors welcome, so I just drove in and drove up to the barn, parked the car, and got out. And they'd apparently had a horse show. They'd just finished having a horse show yesterday. They had hunt trials. And there were some boys out in a the little announcing truck with big announcer things, and they were riding around the field, around the jumps, announcing, playing with the truck, driving real fast. They had every horse in the barn. Kicking the stalls and racing around the pastures because they were frightening them with this loud speaker. No sense at all. There was kind of a little
they
bit.
They were doing what?
They were riding. They had the announcer's truck. They had a little van with big loudspeakers on top. And these two boys, they must have been 16 or 17, were driving the truck top speed around the field, playing with the announcing thing and scaring all the horses to death, making them run and everything. In the pasture, and they had one horse just going wild in his stall. He was throwing his head and kicking the sides of the stall and everything. And I just kind of was walking around.
Where were you?
I was in the barn, just looking around. Said visitors welcome, and I just was walking around looking at the horses. And I wasn't.
So you saw all that going on, the horses were scared.
I could tell they were scared when I walked up. The horses in the field were scared. They were running each other and throwing their heads, and they were frightened by the noise. Well, I was just looking around a little bit, and there weren't any people around. I couldn't find anybody, and so I walked through the barn, and I discovered this little group of people. It was a family, apparently, a couple of women and a lot of sort of half-grown kids, about maybe 10 or 12, that age, and a couple, a man and a woman, that eventually I realized they were sort of in charge. And I just sort of stayed on the edge of the group for a while and just listened. And what they were doing was getting ready to feed the horses. They let them into their stalls. I've never seen anything like it. They just let them out of the pasture one by one, and the horses go into their stall. They don't lead them or anything. It was just like a cow going in a barn, you know. I've never seen a horse do that. But that's how they feed them. And it was a big show. The little kids were helping. You know, they'd hold the doors of the stalls open, and then they'd let out one horse, and the horse would go in his stall. And while they were doing this, the man and the woman were talking about how the place was run. Well, it's a nice looking place. It's a fancy barn. It's got 25 box stalls, and they've got, you know, little automatic waterers, and it's fancy, and the horses are nice, and they're all in nice shape and good condition, beautifully groomed. The appearance is so deceiving because I found out how it's run. Turns out that this young couple lives in the house, and I started talking to the man as he was feeding the horses, and he was putting feed in, you know, and he said that, yes, they'd been out there about a month and a half, or 2 months, just 6 weeks, I guess. He said the rent's $200 on that house, and I told him I couldn't pay that, and what I'd do is I'd give him $150, and I'd work out the other $50. He said I told him I'd work 6 hours a week feeding the horses for him, and I'd be here, you know. He said I was just supposed to be 6 hours. He said I work 25 or 30 hours a week out here. He said, I came out the other morning, and one of the horses had kicked this whole fence down. He said, I spent 8 hours rebuilding that fence. He said, I rebuilt the whole fence coming in here and painted it. He said, I've done so much around
here. How's that wooden fence?
And just as you turn in the gate, there's a white picket fence all the way down.
I stood there and I was leaning on it, and the thing was wobbly. And the posts were rotted out.
Up at the barn?
No.
Or at the house?
At the lean.
As you turn in.
Yeah, you meant further on.
No, I think he meant right there as you turn in.
I
thought that's what he meant.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he
I stood there and watched. I thought they were Arabians over there. I don't know what they were, but they were beautiful horses, and I stood there, and they'd come up and speak to me.
They have got beautiful horses out there, and they really do. They have Arabians, and they've got a lot of quarter horses, and they're beautiful animals, just beautiful. They've got a little filly that's half Arabian and half something else that's for sale. That's the prettiest thing you'd ever want to see in your life. She's just beautiful. And these two, this couple, Diana and Donald, are sort of like managers of the place. And he said, you know, people think we're the managers, but we're not. I'm just supposed to feed the horses and put them out in the pasture. That's all I'm supposed to do. And he said, I put in so much time down here. After I built that fence the other day, I was ready to walk up to the house and just chuck the whole thing. He said, but, you know, I figure it's nice for the kids out here. They have two little kids. And I talked to his wife a little later, and she said, we were living in a second floor apartment in Gainesville, and then they came out to this, and they handle the horses well. You know, they both do. They're not nervous around them or anything. And I said to him, I said, do you ride them? He said, hell no, we don't ride them. He said, I wouldn't ride them. He said, the last guy that was out here started riding one of these boarding horses, and first thing you know, the girl came out and she said, you know, I'm missing some of my tack. And the next week she came out and she said, you know, some of my tack's broken, and you were the last one that rode the horse. Maybe you better fix it. And the next week she came out and said, that horse is dirty. You better wash him for me. He said, I don't want to get into that. I already put in 30 hours a week. He said, if I ever get so bad that I've got to ride a horse, I'll buy one myself. Well, I said, Do these horses all belong to the, I think it's Etheridge, their name is, that owns the place. They never come out. They come out and they teach the classes, but that's all. They're not there at night if one of the horses gets out. They don't even tell them how to properly feed the horses. One of them, Mr. and Mrs. Etheridge, one of them will call up and tell Donald, well, you give Sundancer 2 quarts. And then his wife will call up and tell Diana, well, you give Sundancer 1.5. And Diana just sort of smiled and she said, well, we just sort of feed them what we think they ought to have. If they look a little skinny, we give them a little more. If they look like they're getting fat, we cut down a little bit. She said, we don't worry about it too much. And these expensive, fancy horses. And so I asked her, I said, do these all belong to the Etheridges? And she said, no, only about half of them do. The others are boarders, just $75 a month. Feed and pasture, and they take care of them, put on medicine and stuff if the horse gets hurt. She said, most of the people that own these horses are never here. They never come out. She said, that horse over there, I've never seen their owner. They've never come out in 2 months to look at the horse. These two horses is a mare and a foal, about the size of that one, and a beautiful Palomino, just the prettiest horse you've ever seen, hasn't been out in 2 months to look at them. And I was just, you know, the more they talked, the more I was just horrified. I couldn't imagine that anybody would run a stable like that, and I couldn't imagine that people would buy horses and not. I mean, I can understand if you live in a town, you've got to stable the horse somewhere, but I couldn't imagine that they never came out. I just I couldn't conceive of it. And Donald said, well, that's nothing. He said even the ones that come out, he said he showed me these 2 quarter horses, mares. They look alike. They're both bay and they pretty horses. And he said they belong to a girl on the campus. She's from Miami. And when she was in high school, her father bought her these 2 horses. And she came up here to college, and her father wrote her freshman year, you know, and said, I think I'll sell the horses because you're not going to ride them. Oh, no, she wrote back, and she said, he's telling me all of this, Donald. He's telling me this. Oh, no, she wrote back, and she said, I have to have the horses up here. So he said, they shipped these two horses up here. They put them out here in this stable. They put out $150 a month to keep them here. She comes out maybe once a week. She pats them on the nose. She gives them a little grain, and she leaves. He said, about a week ago, she came out with a friend of hers because they wanted to exercise the horses. So they got them out of the stalls, and they put saddles on them, and they rode them down one fence, and they turned around, and they rode them back to the barn, and they got off, and they put the saddles back in the tack room and put the horses back in the stall. And that, he said, is the extent of their riding. He said, what happens is that people come out here and take lessons, and then they have to have a horse. So they buy these beautiful horses, and he was really, you know, concerned about it. He said, and then they put them out here in this barn, and they just rot. Nobody comes out here to look after them. And he said, there's one horse in there, and we walked in the barn, and he showed me this beautiful red quarter horse. He said, this horse has been here for 5 months. They can't find his owner. His owner left for Fort Lauderdale 5 months ago. He's 4 months behind in his board bill. They keep sending the bill, and it keeps getting sent right back. Nobody at this address. He said, this horse has been abandoned. This $1,000 horse is abandoned here. He said, so what they're going to do, of course, is, he said, that the Etheridges will put a lien on him, and they'll buy him for $100, and then they'll turn around and sell him for $1,000 and get their money out of him. But he said, it's just awful when you think that this horse is just abandoned here. A fine horse like this. Well, I couldn't, at this point, you know, I just couldn't take too much more, because I was saying to God, it just, when I got back and was thinking about it, I set it all down, and I got to thinking about it, and the student in my office, that works in my office, Bob, came in about 2 weeks ago, and he said, it's our fifth wedding anniversary next week, I'm going to buy my wife a horse. And I said, you are going to do what? He said, I'm going to buy her a horse. I said, Bob, does she ride? Oh, no, he said, she doesn't. She used to go to her grandfather's farm when she was a little girl and ride the farm horses, but she liked it a lot, and she's always wanted a horse. I said, Bob, that's the craziest thing I have ever heard of in my life, for you to go out and buy a horse when you don't know anything about it, and neither does she. Oh, he said, buying the horse is no trouble. It's just I'm going to have to find a place to keep it after we buy it. I said, what do you mean buying the horse is no trouble? And I proceeded to enumerate all the things that he could go wrong on. Such as, I said, well, you want to know who owned the horse before. I mean, I don't know much. I wouldn't go out and buy a horse. Me, by myself, I said, you want to know who owned the horse before and what kind of training it had had? You want to know its background? You want to know whether he's trained at all. And you want to know...
Whether the horse got no sense to teach him, or he got no sense to teach the horse,
And he got no sense at all. He just kept laughing about it. He said it's no trouble. I mean, she'd take care of it. I said, there are pastures around where for $10 you can leave the horse out. I said, Bob, do you realize that means you've got to go every day and take care of that horse? You can't go away for the weekend. You can't do anything. You've got to take care of the horse. You can't just put it out in a pasture and leave it there to rot. And he sort of considered a little bit, and he said, the only thing I know about horses is that they get down, and once they get down, you can't get them up again.
That's what buys horses.
I was just horrified. I said, Bob, you just can't do this. If you want to do something for your wife, why don't you give her 6 months of riding lessons? And then if she wants a horse, you buy her a horse, but let her learn how to ride at least before you get her a horse. I said, if she's never ridden a horse, how can you possibly buy a horse for her? And he thought about it for a while, and he came in about 2 days later. He only works every other day, and he came in the next time he came in. He said, you know, I thought about that a little bit. He said, I don't think I'm going to buy her a horse. He said, I think she ought to pick out the horse she wants when we get ready to buy it. And I said, that's a good idea, Bob. So he bought her, and then the next week he came in and he said, I'll give it. He called a couple places in town and found out it was $5 a lesson, and then he came in the next week and he said, well, I've chucked the whole idea of the horse. He said, I'm going to buy her a freezer instead. But it's just those are the kind of people that buy horses today. They buy them and they spend $75 or $100 a month, and the horse just sits and rots. And you know, the family that was out there, the woman, the older woman, started talking, and I thought it was Miss Mary. I honestly did. I thought, what in the world is Miss Mary doing here? Because her voice sounded just like Miss Mary. And I walked around the corner, and she was the grandmother of this family. Her daughter was there, and then all the kids, I guess, were her daughter's children. And she was saying something about, well, when we had horses, and her grandson said, you had a horse? And she said, why, sure we did. It's the only way we had to get around. We had horses. And she walked over. There was this big, beautiful Appaloosa in the stall, really tall horse. And she looked in, and I walked over, and I stood looking in with her. And she said, we had one about that size. And I said, as big as that? And she just took off. She said, horses are so smart. She said, we had a horse like that that my daddy got from the cavalry. And she was pointing at this Appaloosa, you know, but it had a C right there on its rump. And she pointed at the Appaloosa, and you just see the C, you know, that she was seeing. And she said, I used to ride that horse all the time, and we'd plow with it. And she said, one day, I was little, I was only about maybe 14, I was taking this horse with a cart across a ditch. She said, and the wheel of the cart got stuck right in the ditch, and she showed me how wide it was. You know, and I should have known better than that. I was old enough. She said, so I got out of the cart, and I went up to the horse's head. I took hold of his bridle, and she's acting this all out, you know. And I was the only one that was listening to her. Nobody else was listening to her by this time. And she said, I took hold of his bridle like that, and we walked forward, and he stepped
right.
Was
she looking at you?
She was looking at me, yeah. And he stepped right on my foot. She said, right on the arch. And I just went, ooh, you know, because I know how much it hurts. And she said, you know what? I said, no. She said, he just limped on that foot. He knew he stepped on me, and he just limped on that foot, and he stepped forward on the other foot and put his weight on that foot. He never hurt me at all. And she said, horses is so smart. Another thing, when I first walked in, you know, and I couldn't find anybody, and I was just wandering around the barn, and then when I found them, I was sort of standing to one side, leaning on one of the stall doors, just listening. And Donald said, you know, there's a sign out there on the front sign that says visitors welcome, and he was looking at me as he said it, because he didn't know who I was. And he said, Diana always wants to know who everybody is when they come in here. He said, I don't worry about it. I figure if they put that sign up there, it's okay with me if visitors come into this barn. He said, it's their barn, and if they're going to put signs up like that, they're going to have to live with it. Looking at me,
yeah,
you know, like I was up there to steal the horse. And I said, because he was looking at me, I said, yeah, you know, somebody could just come up here with a truck and go off with a horse. He said, they do it all the time. He said, the Etheridges call up somebody and say, oh, yeah, you can go out there and borrow Ginger Snap. And he said, the next thing we know, there's a truck at the barn, and they're loading Ginger Snap, and they take her off for a couple of days. He says, nobody ever tells us that they're going to do this. They never tell us which horse they're taking. They just come and take them. He said, someday, somebody's going to come down here with a big van, load up every horse in the barn, and leave. And they're going to come out here, and they're going to say, what happened to the horses? And I'm going to say, you mean you didn't lend them to somebody? He's got the right attitude. He said, I just refuse to worry about it if they're going
to
put that
he
sign
up. He swings with the punches, doesn't he?
He does. He's got a lot of sparkle. He really does, and his wife does too. I asked her if she rode. Well, he said he didn't ride because he didn't want to be get involved with the boarding horses, because there's so many horses out there that nobody rides, that just sit there, that ought to be ridden. And I asked her if she rode. And she was standing up against one of the stalls. She's kind of plump, and she was standing up against one of the stalls like this, and she said, I don't ride out here. She said, the only kind of saddle I ride in is a western saddle, and all this English stuff. She did her helmet like that. She said, I'm embarrassed.
Well, you know, for all the time that I've been taking Valerie and Margaret out there until the last, well, few times. There hadn't been anybody there at the house.
Well, I don't, they didn't.
And they've just come in, I guess, in 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody lives there.
And they're, you know, they're good with the horses. They're easy with them. They have a feeling for them, or they wouldn't be doing all this.
What were the boys, children that were playing with the sound equipment?
They were with the Denisons. This family was the Denisons, and they had a lot of little girls that rode, and I don't know what the boys did, whether they rode or they had just come to see the show. I think they were friends of Diane and Donald. I didn't get that straight, but I think they'd come to see them out there.
So they made free with the sound equipment.
They did, and they scared all the horses. And the horse that they scared that was bothered the worst about it, turns out, is a stud. And Diana told me that. I asked her if she'd said something about that they brought in some stallions for this show to jump in the show. And I said, oh, well, I guess that caused a lot of trouble around here. You don't have any stallions here, do you? And she said, yeah, they had one, the one that was kicking the stall down. And she said, he nearly died today with all these stallions and mares around. He had a bad time. And she said, you know, he just sits in there all the time. They can't let him out with the other horses. He's just in that stall all the time, and nobody does anything with him. And she said, since we've been here, I take him out every day and run him around the barn a few times, but that's all the exercise he gets. And she said, he's mean as he can be, and it's no wonder. He's just in that stall all day long.
Now, you've got a sort of interplay, without saying it, you see, between easy money and, you see, these animals that they don't take care of, they don't appreciate them, and a little more interesting than that, though, is that where there's no direction at all, somehow or other, the boy takes over. Somehow or other, you see, you get a little direction.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to moralize on it or overstate it, but you see, just talking about it.
Yeah, he's the one that said it more. I don't have to say it because he was saying it all the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, he was saying it while he was working, while he was putting the horses out at night.
Mm-hmm.
And he could talk about the horses, too.
You don't have a tape recorder over there, do you?
No.
Don't leave his mind. See, you've got it all down in there now.
Oh, yeah.
In case you forget something. When you go back over there, you can knock it off in about an hour.
I set it down last night. Once.
You didn't set it down like this, so.
No.
Fill it out.
That's right.
Fill it out. Fill it out.
Yeah.
Go back. Don't do it the first time, but go back and put that fence in. And then
mm-hmm.
go back and put that horse in, that stallion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, don't do it the first time, but then go back and do it. You set it down last night, or
yeah.
You didn't bring it over?
Well, it was just kind of rough. You know, I just put down everything what we talked about, and then once I got into it, that after I typed a couple pages, Bob just came into my mind, because I realized what was happening. I couldn't believe that this was going on, you know, because I just love horses, and I wouldn't, you know, I couldn't believe that people would buy a horse and not care about it. It just was inconceivable to me. And
well, hell, just started, it just seems to be so directly tied into physical health and
the symptoms that the young have. You know, that a bother.
Mm-hmm. No, I think I'm lost again.
I can follow you about it if you have an eye and then cover it, touch ground. Give it a case. The mental health. One thing about mental health is keeping your circulation up and not allowing yourself to be too sedentary and read too much.
Yeah.
Well, that's a rather obvious one.
Well, but sometimes the obvious is hard to cope with. Some people seem to have a capacity for ignoring the obvious. And
You don't have tensions when you work with your hands.
No.
Supposedly.
Mm. I think it's helpful. That's good. And I think just working, exercising your whole body helps a whole lot in working out tensions and anxiety. I started doing an hour's worth of yoga a day, and I did it for a period of 40 days and stopped. I broke an elbow about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, and just got out of a cast. And the noticeable change in stopping for 3.5 weeks after having built up a routine for 6 weeks has been incredible. I've just been this week getting back into being able to do all the positions and all the exercises with the degree of enthusiasm that I could before. And it really makes a noticeable difference in amount of tension.
Yeah, smelling some corn drawing, that must be the best thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, businessman, when you going to start your farming?
Well, I need to see what your feeling is about how much to start on.
Well, I'll tell you what. You need about 20 acres to get the man over here. If you get the man over here, you got 5 acres up there, and you have that done, it won't cost you much. It costs you, $3 or $4 maybe. And I will take up the rest of it around here.
Now, what man are we speaking of coming over?
I'll tell you who he is. I'll write his name down for you. Tell you who he is. He's the only man in this area who does custom work. What I was thinking is, it's so much better to get the heavy work done, custom work, than just do it self.
It takes a bigger plow than he's got.
The bigger plow does it better than the little plow that I've got. It just does better work. And it don't cost anymore. You see, it's costly to use a tractor. If something will happen, you have to put a spark plug in it. And it takes a world of gas. Or that heavy work, you see. Once you get the heavy work done, then it's not much trouble. Then I've got a light tractor in there, that little Ford tractor. That's nice for putting in the road.
You've got a planter?
Yeah, I got about anything you want. What I don't have, you can borrow. You can borrow it.
Linda said she knew where a roadkill was. Is she still interested?
Right.
Oh, yeah. She checked on that. I don't know if she's got a final report, but it looked a little dim, the initial report.
Oh, a lot of people got roadkill.
But,
yeah. But it was cute the way Linda picked it up and said,
yeah.
I just thought that was just wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you who he is. You can get in touch with him. He's easy to get in touch with him. This would be a good time now, whenever you get around to him. Tell him you got 20 acres over here. But it's not all in one piece, and he may not be able to do it at the regular rate.
What do you know what the regular rate is for?
No.
It depends on how much he has to break it, right? Or what kind of shape he leaves it in?
Well, the regular rate is just for 50 acres
field. He has to do a little here.
He got
to
do a little
here.
There, he got somebody training to do it. Yeah. I got to go over to use telephone.
Okay.
All right. That's what I had in mind, just Cookie's horse. I tell you what, if you just wait him out, he'll put a horse over there. You don't have to buy it.
Yeah.
You don't need to own a horse. Oh. Tell him you need a horse that you can plow with.
Well, he said he had a rig over there. Has he ever used it out here?
Well, some of this rig over here belongs to him. But he don't have a... He don't have a plow horse.
He did have, but he doesn't have. Anytime,
It'd be nice to have a plow horse. Because a lot of things, it's easy to use a horse. Just get in there with a...
And then, yeah, his aid, you could ride, and he was a pretty good riding horse, and also he could plow.
Yeah. You want to check those for a while, Milo?
Yeah. Have you got a key to the trail?
Yeah.
Oh, he gave me a key. That concerned me. I was worried about it.
Well,
I don't think you have to be worried about Frank, because he can't drive. His license is taken away for three years. But we never have wanted him, any of those people, to come over here by themselves.
See, I've already gone through that.
Well, what I was curious about, you took me by surprise with wanting to check with the man. Is it time that corn can be planted now?
Hell, you can plant something all the time. You can plant corn now, and you can plant sweet potatoes, and you can plant just about anything. You don't have to wait and take the time. All you got to have is moisture.
Well, there's plenty of that at this particular time.
Yeah.
It seems like it.
Yeah.
It was to me. I just was asking. Cookie was indicating it wasn't. It might not be time. But
well, it's not for Cookie.
Okay.
You
want
to give him the number?
Yeah.
Oh, he don't want to do it now. Next time he comes up, I'll give it to him. He can just think of turn over his mind there, too.
Well, I can check with the guy.
You don't have to. You have to go to school on the 4th?
No.
Well, that'd be a nice time to get your friends over and get a few things done. Let me see. I'll tell you what to do. I'll write it down for you.
What? See yourself now. If you want to wait, it's okay.
Now, this is a young fella who does the work. But I'll give you his daddy's name, and he will refer you to him. Dad is named Robert Williams, and his boy is the one that operates. And you can get both of them on this little form. Robert Williams, he's got this cultivator. Probably want to adjust the price and what he charges. And you get Robert C. in this directory. Robert Williams. I can't think of his boy's name. Robert Williams.
He lives in McIntosh? Or?
Robert, you know where the Shell station is?
Mm-hmm.
Robert lives right in front of it, up on the hill, in one of those big old houses. You can barely see it from the road. And he's one of the fine people. Jack is his name. See, here's W. Robert Williams. It says he's a big Anobi, but he's not. And here is R. Jack Williams, and Jack is the one. So, I guess, I might as well just write it down for you. Jack. You see what I mean? It's so much more trouble to break yourself, and it's not done as well. So if you can get him, and you speak to him, you speak for him. Now what they do is they won't for 20 acres. They won't come. You see, halfway across the county, he'll wait till he's over working over here somewhere close. Before he comes over here.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is kind of sound him out is about when he thinks he can get over here.
Okay. And you don't have any idea what he's going to charge? I thought I'd compare it with what I might, I can just have something to compare it with. I would check with anybody else around.
Anybody else to check with?
Okay.
He's the only one.
John went right between 500 and 600 with Jimmy reporting. He came up. I left a note for him this Tuesday, the 2nd of July, 74. Channel 1 over. Channel 1 over. And the end of this little visit was Jimmy. Around 500 or 600 on this Tuesday, the 2nd of July, 74.
Well, you see, I read the editorials, and I know Cunningham, not personally, but from some time back, and I know that the he's more or less the power over at the university, and I've seen quite a bit of student journalism writing, and it's a special format, it seems like, that's just absolutely without question taught. That's the only way I can describe it, because I've seen that format so many times, and it comes out with a hard one-liner. It's two-thirds of a sentence and a period, very cryptic. And I would, not having gone through their school, I would assume, okay, now this is your attention getter. And whenever they want to make a point, they very frequently slip it in there with a very, very short one-liner. And it's just like Mr. Black smiling at the council meeting in McNopia. When he makes a point, he just sits back and smiles at everybody. And I don't know why it reminds me of that, but it honest to God does. The way they wind up their comments with this little brassy one-liner statement. That's one, it's the choppy, let me see. It'd be the there's not a decent amount of flow or understanding. It's written more from a how do we go about writing it according to formula than it is written with smoothness and a person's feeling of writing. That's poorly stated too, but they're trying to do a journalistic thing and do it for the public. Now I can see the public point. One thing, this was quite well accepted by the public.
Well,
the public I heard.
Yeah, but the pictures carry it.
I think
so. You can write about anything.
I think the pictures do. I think we mentioned it before. One third this amount of writing, well done, could have vastly improved the article. I mean, the whole thing.
Well, now, what was your comments on this little piece over there?
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This piece here? Uh-huh. Last section.
That's right, you mentioned.
Oh, my statement?
Yeah.
Well, I remember that directly. That's... You see, what he did... What he did was take quotations from me and condense them. Because, see, I don't talk like that.
Read it. Are you quoting you?
Yeah, these artists care about what goes on here. They like the place. And if they feel there's a change going on, they get their hackles up faster than anyone. Now,
puts it in his own rhetoric.
I well, he almost had to because he didn't have a tape, to the best of my knowledge. And you can lay a reasonable bet that he even copied it down with his own style. And that's not, when I read it in my head, that's not spoken, and I don't really, well, I mentioned it before that I would, just wouldn't make it that cryptic. Especially casually talking to him like I was on the street. In any one of those statements, I got into further implications on the thing. And they said something else about the sportatorium, and that was all condensed down to nothingness. You know, it's absolutely meaningless.
Yeah.
It doesn't. It's incorrect. Their statements, and furthermore, it has absolutely no background and no further relationship. It's just something dropped in here. And why in the hell they don't learn that in journalism, which is one of the old criteria? You know, if it doesn't have any point, leave it out. General writing, short story or whatnot. But hell, they stick just about anything in there they can think of.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you have in mind when you
said that? It states reasonably well what I would have in mind, but it's just too harsh. I mean, I know I would talk about the. It's hard to resurrect all that stuff, guy. And I don't know that I'd use the term artist to start with. I shy away from that. I use the term young people, which is getting a little bit out of hand, too. We've got a pretty good group of over 30 people now in the area. But, I mean, there's a group of people there that do care. About, to some extent, about what goes on in the area.
The old timers.
No, these are the young people that have moved in there and lived there for a while, and they stay asleep until we get something pointed out, and if you point it out to them, they'll wake up and raise hell about it. But they're not politically active animals, you might say. They don't stay on top of the situation. They need somebody to stir them up, poker. To make this kind of thing clear to the public, this possibly is ingrained in journalistic writing. They want to categorize everything, pigeonhole it. They want to call them this group of 15 artists, or this group of 12 that, and then they want to talk about the old timers and the artists, or the old timers and the young people. And that's just not the way it is. It's not categorical over there.
There's not that much direction.
No.
Even among the artists.
God Almighty, I mean, I'm not categorical. And I mean, it seems like I'm a member of the group over there, but I stay by myself a lot of times. And the directions I take are not their directions. Very few of them understand what the hell I'm doing. I'm talking about the younger people.
Well, let me tell you what I was thinking of. Now, you've got, you remember, you finally read Faye's little piece on Pop
mm-hmm.
Burke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You see, that goes along right nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's informative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no comedy in it. It's informative. She may have a light touch, but she's looking at Papa Burke. And frames it all, of course, on this arthritis, business about arthritis. Well, now, what I would say, Wade, is that has more about Papa Burke in it
than any of the journalists could write or the creative writers could write. The journalist has got such a small, this is unusual, it's so big. Now here's the one on cooking. It's smaller than I thought it was. See, all he got is just this column. He got as much in pictures as he has in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got so much leeway, his details, his circumstances are all, like you say, abbreviated and all. I'll tell you about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, now you got your two ways of looking at it. The journalist or the creative writer or somebody like Fay and Debbie doing the sort of thing I'm trying to do. it's like the article on Hawthorne. It was written in 1928 when Hawthorne was coming under survey after the 19th century reputation. He'd been re-examined by the new scholars. Well, in this particular article, they examined him from a position of doubt, and it's very instructive. And what the writer says is that Hawthorne didn't have much to say, and he had very little skill in saying it. Now you got your two things there. What this writer is capable of seeing, and then what he's able to set down.
Mm.
Now you see, Miss Mary and the bull, she's lived with that bull, and it's the experience has validity about it. And in her way, she reports on that bull. If you listen to it, it's not written. It's if you listen to it. I can't. That you just I just have to set that up. Well, now Fay has lived with Papa Burke for several years, and been right close to him. Not her father-in-law, you see. And she takes in the family. She lives closely with him. He retired, he had a bad time, and it was partly emotional, and this kind of arthritis he had was not the crippling kind. So you see, the Dr. Dufresne would be able to lead him out of it. He got a hold of himself, you see, and got that arthritis out of his bloodstream, or whatever it is, I don't know how you say it. Well, Fay has been doing that since 1960. She has been looking at those experiences. She picked up a little of it down here with me, and she's kept it up. And she's also learned to go to typewriter, what I call go to typewriter. She doesn't frame them, you see, for journalism or for creative writing. She puts it down like she and Debbie did. Miss Mary, you saw that, the reports on that visit over there. Well, and this thing about Papa Burke, you see, she just put it down. Didn't take any time. I don't know how many hours she put on it, maybe two or three. That's all. But she had just been up there 3 days and lived it solid, you see, so it was in her mind. And then she talked about it over there at Ernest Cox's that Friday morning. And that afternoon, she came back and talked about it here and went over after the children left Friday afternoon. She went over and started typing on it. I told her Ernest would like to see it. So, you see, it's not a matter of how much time you put on it. The creative writing takes so much time. This stuff doesn't take time. And generally, I'd say the journalists can sit on the bench with you 15-20 minutes and find out your point of view. Well, see, that's one of the great superficialities of the media. They all do that. That's all the time they got for you.
They only listened about 2 minutes of that.
Okay. Now, about this piece here, the only reason I got into it was that I couldn't make anything of it to start with, and then I found out what you thought about it, and that sort of was a prod for me, sort of like twisting your tail. So I thought, well, hell, I'll get into it and see a little bit. Debbie read it, and she didn't make anything of it, and she didn't even read the article. She just started it. I said, hell, Debbie, don't just start an article. Offer to come in here and talk to me about the article. That's the mentality she's adopting, you see, being on that campus. So I got back into it. Now, I'd say this. I'd say it's not stylized as you say it is. I'd say he has far more information than I've seen in one of these articles, and he can't hardly handle it. And you see, he starts out with a quote, and you don't know who's saying it. Well, you know he didn't do that on purpose. He just hadn't quite. Here is an artist. Why can't you just do this? Here's an artist named Paul Fullerton, and this is what he's into. And well, that's not Paul Fullerton. See, you don't know who says that first. He says, tall and skinny and hidden beneath a vintage army cap, he laid down the broom and looked up. Well, you know, after you study it, that it's this fellow over here with the army cap on. But you don't know it over here. So it's just awkward, I'd say. But he got a vast amount in it. Now, you see, he makes these two little points to start with, but they're not single points. They're just thrown in. One is, you see, this thing about hostility, and the other is an artist colony. You see, neither one's true. The city of Micanopy, and then he makes his big, funny statement. Yeah, he just throws these things together. That may be a little stylized. Home to about 870 people, 240 horses, homes. Transient diesel trucks, Paul's 4-month-old puppies. You see, he just that may be stylized. There's maybe a little part of it stylized, but there's how loosely it goes, and there's only one thing that holds them together, and that's the feeling that Micanopy ought to stay the way it is. Well, now he doesn't get back to that until he gets over to the end, and that's where he uses your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say in that case, there's validity to it. Because you're the chief one who's sort about that. And that's where it is. And he brings them in along with it. That's the end.
Yeah, but he knew, maybe he could sense that, but he doesn't handle it all the way through, so it points up the fact that maybe I was involved in it.
No, he doesn't.
He just comes in and throws out a sharp quote. I mean, a very concise little quote there.
No, it's not
on
concise.
Me.
It's a good bit of it.
Oh, okay.
This on you.
Yeah.
Now on this, this is the history of it. Arriving in Micanopy can be disconcerting if you're looking for a bohemia. And here's how it came about, you see. Hollis Holbrook. And here's old Micanopy that Hollis Holbrook saw and thought that would be a refuge for the artists, protecting them against what goes on in Gainesville. Now, I don't know, that's probably not right. He probably just picked up things about the three hotels, and all of them burned up and all. But that is more history than I've seen in any of these things. So he don't know anything about the history. He just got it from talking to somebody. But nobody that talks about the history of Micanopy. I've never heard anyone talk about it.
Very little known about it. Can't even find anything written about it.
No. And here's the center. Now, as for the center, now let me tell you, I won't go into the detail, but in this part here, May Sue Hammaker talks about it as a center, and then
he picks up the individuals. I didn't notice that at first. I thought he was just using quotes, but he tries to put the individuals in. I see, there they are. Here's Rosemary and Bill and so on.
You
down
see,
the block.
One of my problems on that, I know these individuals.
Yes,
and,
I know.
And he didn't meet them.
Well, now he's talking to.
But he tries, you know.
He's talking to Sandra Hiley. He's there where Fullerton is sweeping up the wood, and he's there talking to her. And Sandra Hiley, yes. But it's not Sider. Now that you see from here on down, that's the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes back to the end of Micanopy, you might say. So there's. Now you'd have to look, if you'd look at it from that point of view, that he is got way yonder more information. It's not necessarily correct information, but he's got way more than he can handle.
Yeah.
So that it's rough rather than stylized. I think what he's doing, you see. I think what he's doing, he's putting more in an editorial and a feature story than the work. Now this is more like a feature story, and he starts off with a picture of Cookie behind these things sweating, and then he says he may not do this long because he's got to go to Sanitarium and take out one lung. And those horses, you see, is what he pins the whole thing on. The rest of the article is on those horses. His daddy had this. Sire, a mare, the foal mare of these horses, back in 1942, and they were the last foals. And he works it out, and it's a right nice little case, the story of the horses.
Just keeps it there.
Yes, and it's a pretty fair piece of workmanship.
Mm-hmm.
But now, that's about all it'll hold. In other words, he talks about Cookie in terms of the horses, and then he tells over here, I've used a 10-inch plow and a 12-inch plow and a 14-inch plow. You judge the size of your plow by the size of your horses. Well, hell, these things would use a big plow. They're about as big as they come. Well,
I think you're right on to that. Too much information. To make it run smooth. There's just all, any one of those personalities in there would require work.
Yeah.
You know, just about any one of them, and if you meet them briefly, you got to mishandle them almost.
There's more information than he can handle, and there's more than a feature story will tolerate. That is
tolerate.
So it's an artistic mistake on his part, basic, and then inexperience.
It's better than anything to come out yet about Micanopy.
Yeah.
I was just doing a general, I haven't even complained publicly about it. I'm just sort of moaning a little bit on the side.
Well, it don't matter about that. I'm just saying now. Now, what you got, I'm thinking about the kind of reporting we do out here based on the kind of reporting that the countryside does. If you look at Micanopy, you see now there's you can start in on the loopholes on this, on where it's short. He talks about the feud between the newcomers and the old timers, but there's not one old timer in it. Not a sign of an old time record. Well,
that's a one-sided feud, ain't it?
Well, actually, you see, and this thing on Cookie's not in it.
Yeah.
It's just his ailment and the horses.
Besides the plow.
So you see, they have no gift, no skill in handling the redneck, so to speak. You've got your big division there. And what you said, Mr. Thrasher won't rent to these newcomers. The only people he rent to are the rednecks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, that's what the world's come to. We call them all rednecks. That's way down the scale, you see, if they knew that. They might spit me out.
You should have heard the discussion that went on in my kitchen with Jack Sander and Jeff Sterling and me and a couple of other guys back there trying to decipher out what the hell was a redneck. I wish I'd had a tape on that one. They went around and they stuck with the idea of trying to figure out what a redneck was, and Jack would give his opinion, and that was marvelous.
Well, now you go back to those two little categories, the quality of their experience, their faculty, their ability to see, like Miss Mary on the bull,
yeah.
She sees the bull, and the faculty for reporting. This kind of, that's Mama. She got three young ones. They're all as big as she is now. She still clerks at them and feeds them. my hunch, the thing that I'm working from is that you won't see McAnope through the creative writers. They wouldn't even undertake it. Don't you know, when Rick was working on that Revolution of Micanopy, he had a vast amount of stuff, and he got it shaped pretty much where it's barely readable. And he took it up in Alton, and Alton was impressed with it, and he says, well, have you taken this over to the creative writers?
Well,
you're going to reduce this much material to one little short story. So you see, you've got society and the institution up there where they fall short. You want to see McAnope? Well, you see, they see it through what little experience they have, and that won't be much. But they look at it through your eyes. But you see, they are able to do that. Just like they look at the Zane's Brain with Bull through Miss Mary's eyes. I'll get you a cup of it. I don't have one, I just look for them. These people that I'm calling the writers now, I've got no other name for it. A writer can see it more clearly than the journalist. I don't think the creative writer sees anything clearly. I think it's all warped and on by his point of view. I think it distorts everything, so he don't need to see it clearly. Now I can't say that publicly. but now, I've been gullible all my time. You see, I've thought about all these fine creative writers. I've been taken. That's the fact of it. Well, now the reporting of it, you see, they take it to the typewriter, and you see how easily Debbie does it.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing fades. Now that's